And as Richard said, this sermon is part of a series called A Walk in the Old Testament. But as your tour guide tonight, I have to give a warning as we think tonight about Saul under the title of A King Undone. I have to give a warning as your tour guide tonight. This will not be a carefree walk through the cornfields. This won't be a sort of a leisured stroll in leafy glades or a merry skip and gamble through banks of bluebells or a wistful wander amongst the wisteria. It's not really that sort of sermon. Instead, it's actually going to take us into an incredibly tense situation, and more particularly into an incredibly poignant piece of dialogue about that long, and more particularly still into the heart of an unsolved mystery. Now, I don't apologise for that, but you know, because there's a season for everything. But I just mention it so that tonight, if you feel like the carefree, the leafy, and the merry skip, then you better make alternative arrangements. I don't know what you want to do, but this sermon will not be like that. We're going to walk under four headings. The first heading is this: it's not cricket. The second heading is, it's not fair. The third heading, it's not funny. And the fourth heading, well, I think perhaps the fourth heading can wait, because there's nothing worse than an over-organized walk. So we'll leave that one. So the first heading tonight, as we set off, it's not cricket. Or, alternatively, the world can be a nasty, bleak, and desperate place. And in our reading that Robin gave us, we are in the 11th century BC. And we're about to witness the end of something. It's the end of Israel as a tribal league and the beginning of Israel as a monarchy. So that's a very big shift. And what causes this shift? What crisis? The Philistines. Now, Philistines, we've all heard of them. They were Israel's neighbours, which, of course, as we all know from personal experience, is another way of saying they didn't get on. So not all the Philistines were as tall as Goliath, but they all were fairly mean sort of bunch, really, I think. As a people, they were very, very well armed militarily, and they had a very strong centralised government. Now, the Israelites, on the other hand, were very poorly armed and had no military organisation at all, really. It wasn't so much that the Israelites were in two minds about everything, they were in 12 minds about everything, which is not a recipe for military success. And this meant, to cut a long story short, that when they had neighbourly feuds, the Philistines were winning. So in 1 Samuel 4, there's a clash there. The Israelites brought along the Ark of the Lord's presence, which was their equivalent of a sort of prayer meeting. And the Philistines brought along some high-tech, iron-tipped spears. And it was no contest. The iron-tipped spears won. The defeat of Israel was terrible and total. The Ark was captured. The Israelite priesthood was killed or dispersed. The central shrine at Shiloh was captured and destroyed, and the forces of the tribal league were scattered. Well, no wonder Israel wanted a king. They desperately needed a figurehead or a focus around which to unite. And Saul, our subject tonight, was the man they chose. And he was tall, and he was good-looking, and he cut quite a dash. But he wasn't just the people's choice. He was their choice, but he wasn't just the people's choice. He was also Samuel's choice, and Samuel was sort of God's man on the spot. Samuel, who had been guiding Israel through these dark, dark days. And he's another key figure in tonight's drama. So how do we describe Samuel? He's a holy man. He's part prophet, he's part priest, he's a part civil servant without the pension, but he's very, very influential man, a very influential man. And so Saul, backed by the people and by Samuel, was acclaimed to be God's choice, and he became king. But facing him on his first day at the office was a lot of unresolved tension. So it's nothing like what Helen is stepping into tomorrow morning. Because here we have a lot of unresolved tension. First of all, there was the Philistines, the terrible fear of the Philistines. Secondly, there was the whole business of the fact that the 12 tribes did want someone to lead them, but then again, did they really? Because it's nice to have your independence, isn't it? And then thirdly, there's this very, very interesting relationship between Saul and Samuel. Samuel seems to have had mixed feelings the whole time. It's a very interesting relationship, but we're going to come back to that in a moment. But in the meantime, we just note this, that A, this was not a job I would have applied for, and B, at last we're up to date with chapter 13, in which we walk straight into a crisis. Because in the face of escalating conflict, Saul uses his newly received authority, his royal authority, to call up troops from the 12 tribes. And they turn up, which is a good start, isn't it? It's a very good start, they turn up. But, and it's an enormous but, they are faced by a terrifying show of strength from the Philistines. And if you want to know how terrifying, look at verse 5. They had troops the numbers of the sand on the seashore in multitude. But you see, it wasn't just the numbers. It wasn't just them. It was also the Philistines' equipment. I mean, they had chariots, for goodness sake. They had chariots. And Israel had no chariots. Not a chariot in sight. Israel was a chariot-free zone. But it wasn't just the numbers and the chariots. It was also the question of the swords and the spears. Israel had no swords and no spears. And you say, what? Well, surely the Israelite army had swords and spears. And I say, no, they didn't, you see. Like I said, I wouldn't have applied for Saul's job. They had no swords or spears. Because you see, the Philistines didn't allow them to have blacksmiths of their own. And that's very humiliating, isn't it? They even had to go to the Philistines, we're told, for their garden tools. Well, if they needed permission for a hoe or a pair of secateurs or something, then what hope for a quiet order for 20,000 spears? I suppose they could say it was for the vegetables, but I don't think the Philistines would have believed them. So even with a king, Israel was on the rack. This wasn't cricket. This was nasty and bleak. Israel was outnumbered and outarmed. And of course, what happens? Well, as we heard in the reading, the people begin to desert. Well, that's the nature of the crisis that Saul is facing in chapter 13. People are beginning to desert. Well, of course they are. What does he do? What does he do? He's in a quandary. He needs to do something decisive, but he can't. And you say, well, he can't? Why not? He's king. Oh, yes, he's king, you see, but he can't because Samuel has told him to wait. He's told him to wait for 7 days, just to stop, not to do anything, be patient. Well, would you have been? Saul was. Saul did wait, and Saul was patient. He obeyed Samuel. He waited. But then, as we heard, after 7 days, Samuel still hadn't turned up. There was still no sign of Samuel and every sign of the Philistines. So, what would you have done now? It's your problem. You're king. You've been chosen from just such a moment as this. You've been chosen to lead. What did Saul do? He took a decision. With a deserting army, he takes the office of priest himself. He'd done it before. It was accepted practice. He makes the necessary sacrifice to God. As Samuel said, it was crucial, and so he did. And it's over. What happens now? Samuel turns up. Well, it's about time, really. But Saul's delighted. I think I would have felt a bit offhand, to be honest with Samuel, if I was Saul. I think I would have felt a bit piqued. But amazingly, Saul says, you know, with an amazing lack of hostility, he gives him a welcome. Saul welcomes him. What does Samuel do? Does Samuel return the greeting and say, "Hello, Saul, it's nice to see you and you're doing so well"? No, he doesn't. No, he fires him, basically. He removes his desk from the office. He takes his nameplate off the door. He says, "Saul, you're not fit to be king. You're finished." And if I'd been Saul, I don't know, I mean, Saul was a nicer man than me, but if I'd been Saul, I might have said, "But hang on a minute, but that's not fair." So our first heading was, it's not cricket. The world is frequently a nasty, bleak, and desperate place, and it certainly is in 1 Samuel 13, if you were an Israelite. Our second heading is, it's not fair. Or, things happen in the world which to us and to others are not fair. Now, I don't envy any leader their job. I don't envy any leader, whether they're politicians or business leaders or religious leaders. I don't envy Samuel. I don't envy Samuel the load that he carried. Leadership amidst a time of turmoil and crisis and change is very costly on that lone figure out at the front. So I don't envy Samuel. But I certainly don't envy Saul either. Almost friendless amidst the oppression and aggression of the Philistines, amidst the independence of the 12 tribes, and amidst the ambivalence of Samuel. I don't envy him, his position, and now he's fired. He's accused, he's found guilty, and he's finished. And as has been said by many people, on the scriptural evidence that we have, which is all we have for this, it's actually quite hard to see why. Because Saul appears to have acted not only reasonably throughout, but also responsibly and faithfully. As we've said, he waited the required length of time for Samuel. And as we've also noted, he'd made sacrifices before. This wasn't new. And perhaps above all, are the words that Samuel said 3 chapters previous. But he said to Saul, he said this. You may have forgotten these words, but they're quite important. He said this: "From this time on, Saul, do as you think fit, because the Lord will be with you." Well, he had done, and now he's fired. One of the good things about the Bible, which makes it quite the most scintillating religious book in the world, is that, in one sense, there are no goodies or baddies in it. If you want sort of one-dimensional goodies and baddies, go to an airport lounge bookstore. You better go there, because you won't find them in the Bible. Because in the Bible, you'll find something else. You'll find real people. Real people like you and me, who are part good and part bad, part saint and part sinner, part marvellous, part maniac. And the wonderful thing, of course, about the Bible is that there, amidst the part marvellous and part maniac, is God at work. And so here we are, this clash of people. What's going on here? That's what I want to know. What's going on between Samuel and Saul? And I wonder, is Samuel finding it hard to face up to the fact that Saul is there? Is he being threatened by it, do you think? Both as a leader and as a priest. I only say that because if I was Samuel, I would. You think about it, Samuel's been leading these people for a long time now. And suddenly, here is Saul. He's now leading them. It's very hard to step down and to let go if you are a leader. And then maybe also, Samuel was beginning to feel his particular line of business was under threat, being a priest. This new monarchy idea. I mean, if they're going to start doing sacrifices, well, where does that leave the priesthood? I can understand that. It would be a bit like Richard sort of appointing someone to come and work a club and Richard bringing him down and saying to me, oh, hello, Simon, I'd like you to meet Mick. Mick here, in fact, is going to make your job largely irrelevant, Simon. So do look after him, please, and help him to feel very much at home. And I'd be going, And so we have this clash with Saul and Samuel in verses 13 and 14. And whatever its roots, and probably, like in most human conversations, the roots are many and confused and tangled. Whatever its roots, the words have enormous significance. Because for once Samuel had withdrawn his support from Saul, Saul's days were numbered. It's similar in a way, without pressing the parallel too far for obvious reasons, it's similar in a way to say Geoffrey Howe standing up in Parliament when he denounced Margaret Thatcher while she was still Prime Minister. It wasn't the decisive moment, it wasn't when she resigned, but it was a very crucial moment in the whole series that led to it, the whole process that led to it. Words are very powerful. And certainly these words from Samuel are very powerful. This was a decisive moment for Saul, particularly in the face of a new star on the distant horizon called David. And I've got a question. I've always got questions, and I've certainly got a question here. Was Saul worse than anybody else? Well, as I've reflected on the book of Samuel, which is an amazingly frank piece of journalism, I have to say I don't think he was particularly worse than anybody else. We've witnessed his faithful and obedient waiting for Samuel already, and his apparent lack of bitterness of the prophet's late arrival. And elsewhere we hear that he was modest, that at his best he was magnanimous, that he was willing to admit faults in himself, and that he was courageous. Now that's not a bad reference at all. I mean, there have been people employed at the clubhouse with references that weren't half as good as that. And I should know because I was one of them. But you see, what we discover here from now on in the book of Samuel is something else about Saul. That actually he's going to be a loser. He's going to be one of life's losers. And there are lots of losers in the world. And Saul is going to be one of them. He's going to be famous for it, in a way. He's going to be like a sort of celebrity loser. Name the most famous losers in the Bible. Oh, well, Saul, etc., etc. He's like a celebrity loser. He's a bit like Frank Bruno, only much, much more tragic than that. Because what becomes apparent from here on in his character is something which is so far hidden. And that's a streak of emotional instability, which under pressure brought terrible, terrible mood swings, depression and darkness, which almost, and probably did, threatened his sanity. And so a king acclaimed becomes a king undone. Saul was to be one of life's losers. He'd done his best, but he'd been fired. And from here on, he was a destructive and desperate and unattractive loser on a painful spiral downwards. And he was, in fact, a loser to the end, right to the very end. He died on the battlefield with his three sons. They were killed by others. Saul killed himself in the face of severe wounds. And their carcasses, all four of them, dad and three sons, were hung on the wall of Bethshan. Not the sort of family grave that any of us would wish for. A loser's life, a loser's death, and a loser's grave. And David, as we all know, was in many ways equally flawed, and yet somehow he comes out smelling of roses, whereas Saul comes out of it smelling of something else. It's not fair. But then you don't need me to tell you that. You don't even need scripture to tell you that, because you know that from your own life, and you know that from the news, and you know that from the prayers that we heard tonight. It's not fair. It's no great insight. It's all too obvious. I mean, I was walking across Fitzroy Square with my 7-year-old daughter the other day, and we were contemplating the fact that the children's playground in Regent's Park then still wasn't open. They've had ages to do it up. Broken promise after broken promise. Yes, it'll be ready next week. You know, here we are in the height of summer, and it's not open. And she said to me, she says, "It's not fair, is it?" And I said, "No, isn't really. It's not cricket. It's not fair. And neither is it funny." And our third heading is this: it's not funny. Losing is not funny. Failure is not funny. Which is why, I suppose, ironically, we make so many jokes about it. We make a lot of jokes about failure and a lot of jokes about losing. It's a way to cope with it. And it's a healthy way. Anger turned outwards is wit. Anger turned inwards is depression. So there are lots of jokes about losing. So obviously, supporters of Chelsea Football Club have a lot of jokes. And there is the one where the supporter gets to the turnstile and he hands over 10 quid and he says, "Two, please." And the man says, "Two what? Two forwards? Two fullbacks? Two middle?" And the Chelsea supporter, whose dog whines every time they lose. The dog whines every time Chelsea lose. And someone says, "He whines every time they lose. What does he do when they win?" Champ says, "I don't know, I've only had him a year." So we make jokes about losing, really, to try to deflect it. Because it's not funny, losing. But then you don't need me to tell you that, either. For you have lost. You have lost. Some of us in big ways, some of us in small ways. But we know how it feels. We know the quiet desperation, and sometimes we know the screaming desperation. And none of it feels remotely good or spiritual or pleasing. And we all have different ways to cope with it. But at the end of the day, one thing's for sure: it's not cricket out there, it's bleak. And it's not fair out there. Frequently, justice is not done. And thirdly, it isn't funny. Now, we're trying to enjoy a walk in the Old Testament. But what we're becoming aware of is there isn't a sign of a bluebell or leafy glade anywhere. It's a fairly sparse walk. So before we get to our fourth heading, let's pause, just find yourself a little grassy knoll, and listen to a story. After all, things can't get any worse. And it's a story about a man who had a horse. And one day the horse ran away, and all the villagers came up to the man and said, "Oh, it's a real shame about your horse running away." And the man said, "Well, could be bad news, could be good news." A week later, the horse came back. But it didn't come back by itself. It came back with lots and lots of really beautiful wild horses. So suddenly the man had lots of horses. And the villagers all ran up to him and said, "Brilliant news about the horses." And he said, "Well, it could be good news. It could be bad news." Well, a little while later, the man's son was trying to break the wild horses in. He got thrown by one of them. He fell off and he broke his leg. The villagers came running up to the man and said, "Really bad news about your son." And he said, "Well, it could be bad news. It could be good news." A little while later, war broke out. And there was conscription. And they came to take his son away to go to war. But he couldn't go to war because he had a broken leg. So the villagers came up and said, "Really good news about your son." And he said, "Could be good news. Could be bad news." Well, that's a story that can go on for some time, but I think we'll we'll pause. Perhaps we'll take a pause there. And what I like about that story is its perspective. And it's a perspective that leads to our fourth heading. It's not cricket, it's not fair, it's not funny, but it's not the end either. Losing is not the end. For with our God, nothing is the end. There's one thing that I noticed about our first reading tonight. I mean, I'm no biblical scholar or anything, but I noticed it almost immediately. And what I noticed was this. It's in the Old Testament. Perhaps, I don't know if any of you noticed that as well. If you did, I think you ought to get ordained immediately. But one of the things about the Old Testament, there are many things about the Old Testament, but perhaps the biggest thing it means is this, that as Saul, you remember Saul, as Saul lived and died amidst the hill country of Judea, there was quite an important hill that he couldn't see. As he lived and died amidst the hillside of Judea, there was quite an important hill that he couldn't see. And in fact, the hill in question is a hill just outside Jerusalem in the first century AD, distinctive for a small crowd and three crosses. Can you picture it? And on the middle cross, can you see the middle cross? There was a disfigured human being who'd been treated extraordinarily unfairly, a cornered, tortured, humiliated, taunted, crucified loser, who also happened to be the Son of God. Now, Saul, of course, wouldn't have seen him. Nor would he have heard the words that this man cried out, "My God, my God, why have you abandoned me?" though he might have understood the feelings. And crucially, Saul would have missed something else as well. For he'd not have witnessed God raising this supposed loser 3 days later back to life in perhaps his most decisive act in history. Now, if he had seen and heard that, it might have helped. Why? I mean, how can any loser be helped? Isn't it just a sort of, you know, let them cry on the shoulder job, really? How can any loser really be helped, particularly by theology? I think it could have been helped, because those 3 days between the cross and the resurrection, those 3 days add up to an amazing discovery. The discovery that while history only remembers the winners, that's not true of God. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. God knows too much about the pain of losing in his own gut, from his own family history, to be anything other than very, very close to those sharing in the losing experience, whatever form it takes. Oh, I mean, I feel alone amidst it. I feel alone. I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose tomorrow. I don't seek losing. It feels neither good nor spiritual nor pleasant. My God, why have you abandoned me? But in truth, it's not the end. Losing is not the end. Nothing is the end. Neither life, nor death, nor principalities, nor angels, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor losing, nor anything else in all creation. Nothing is the end with our God. Not even perhaps hanging on the walls of Beth Shan with your 3 sons. Our walk tonight has been gloomy throughout. And certainly we're looking at a terrible and dark skyline. I know that, and it's really one that I'm not even qualified to open my mouth about. The dark and terrible skyline of losing. I wonder when it was darkest for you. All I think I can say is this. The walk has led us to a different place from where we started. We're looking now at the skyline from a different place. Because we're looking at this dark skyline from a hillside now. And we're looking at it from a garden. We're looking at this terrible and dark skyline of losing from a hillside where God is being crucified, and from a garden where God is being raised. And from this new place, from the hillside and from the garden, we're glimpsing something for the first time. Can you see it? Because we're glimpsing cracks in the cloud. We're glimpsing gold amidst the grey. We're glimpsing hope amidst the hurt. For the hillside and the garden are confirming a rumour. The cross and the empty tomb are confirming a rumour. A strong rumour. A persistent rumour. What rumour? The rumour of the presence of God amidst the losing. the rumor of the presence of God amidst the losing. Imagine it. Just for a moment, imagine it somewhere deep inside your soul, in the part of you that has lost or is losing. Imagine what a difference it would make if that rumor turned out to be true. It's not cricket. It's not fair. It's not funny. But it's not the end.